Rock.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration will be the fourth one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And this is titled Belinus and Brennius. Belinus and Brennius, the two sons of Dunvalo, each of whom was determined to inherit the kingship, now began a great war of attrition against each other. Their object in this struggle was to decide which of the two should be crowned king of the realm. They fought a great number of battles with each other, but at length their friends intervened to make peace between them. These friends decided that the kingdom should be divided between the two of them, in such a way that Belinus should be crowned king of the island, and hold Logria, Cambria, and Cornwall, he being the elder, for Trojan custom demanded that the highest office offered by the inheritance should go to him. They also decided that Brennius, on the other hand, who was the younger, should be subject to his brother, but should rule Northumbria from the Humber, as far north as Caithness. A treaty was therefore drawn up to embody these points of agreement, and for 5 years the two of them ruled the country peacefully and justly. The spirit of discord is, however, perpetually on the watch for a chance to put an end to a state of prosperity. Certain ingenious liars came to Brennius and put the following argument to him. "How can you be so cowardly," they asked, "as to let yourself be domineered over by Belinus, when the fact that you have the same father and mother, and the same nobility of birth, makes you his exact equal? To this, you can add that on the many occasions when Ceolfus, the leader of the Moriani, has tried to gain a foothold in the country, it has been you who have shown in a long series of battles that you could stand up to him, and who have driven him back out of your territory. Why do you not break this agreement, which does you so little honour? Marry the daughter of Elsingius, king of the Norwegians, and with his help recover your lost dignity." When they had corrupted the mind of Brennius with these arguments, and with others of a like nature, the young man agreed to do what they had suggested. He went off to Norway and married the king's daughter, just as he had been advised by the hangers-on about whom I have told you. When this came to the ears of his brother Belinus, the latter was most indignant that Brennius should have acted against him in this way, without any prior consultation. Belinus marched into Northumbria, seized the cities of the people born in those parts, and garrisoned them with his own men. The news of what his brother Belinus had been doing was immediately reported to Brennius. He fitted out a fleet and hurried back towards Britain, bringing with him a vast army of Norwegians. As he sailed on across the sea, expecting no immediate attack, and with a favourable wind behind him, he was assailed by Gynctalicus, king of the Danes, who had followed in his wake. Gynctalicus was passionately in love with the girl whom Brennius had married. He was so incensed by what had happened that he had prepared a fleet and an army, and was now pursuing Brennius as fast as his ships could sail. In the sea battle which ensued, Gynctalicus seized the ship on which the girl was, threw grappling irons on board, and dragged it away into the middle of his own fleet. As the two sides joined battle in scattered formation and forced their way through the deep sea, a squall got up, and suddenly headwinds began to blow. Their ships were dispersed and cast ashore upon different coasts. The Danish king was driven along by the hostile fury of the winds. He ran before them for 5 days, and then he landed with some trepidation on the Northumbrian shore, taking the girl with him. He had no idea to what country this untoward accident had carried him. When the local inhabitants discovered what had happened, they seized the two of them and took them to Belinus, who was on the seashore awaiting his brother's arrival. There were 3 other ships alongside that of Gynctalicus, one of them belonging to Brennius's fleet. When the new arrivals revealed their identity to King Belinus, he was delighted. Belinus was all the more pleased that this should have happened to him at a moment when he was so determined to take vengeance on his brother Brennius. A few days passed, and then Brennius managed to reassemble his ships and land on the coast of Albany. When he learned that his wife and certain of his men had been captured, and that his brother had wrested the kingdom of Northumbria from him during his absence, Brennius sent messengers to Belinus to demand that his territory and his bride should both be handed back to him. He swore that if this were not done, he would ravage the whole island from sea to sea, and that, what is more, he would kill his brother, if only the opportunity arose of meeting him on the field of battle. When Belinus learned this, he flatly refused what was demanded. He called together the entire military force of the island and advanced into Albany, ready to meet Brennius in battle. As soon as Brennius heard that what he had asked for had been refused, and that his own blood brother was marching against him in this way, he went forward to meet Belinus in a forest called Calaterium, determined to do battle with him there. The two of them took up their positions in the same open field and divided their troops into companies so as to be ready to engage at close quarters those advancing against them. They spent the greater part of the day in their conflict, for on both sides the men who were fighting hand to hand were extremely brave. Much blood was shed on this side and that, and the weapons which they brandished so lustily inflicted deadly wounds. Those who were wounded where the battalions met in conflict fell to the ground as if they had been standing corn cut by the reaper's sickles. In the end, the Britons were victorious. The Norwegians fled to their ships with their lines of battle slashed to pieces. Belinus followed hard behind them as they ran, cutting them down without pity. 15,000 men fell in that battle, and of those left alive, not 1,000 escaped unwounded. With great difficulty, Brennius himself managed to escape in a single ship, to which good fortune led him as he ran. He sailed off to the coast of France, but the others who had come over with him found hiding places wherever chance led them. As soon as he had won this victory, Belinus summoned all his leaders to York, for he wanted to discuss with them what he should do with the King of the Danes. The king had sent word from his prison that he would be prepared to submit himself and his kingdom, together with the Danes themselves, to Belinus, and to pay tribute every year, if only he were permitted to depart in freedom with the woman he loved. To this, he added that he would confirm the pact by an oath and by giving hostages. When the leaders had been assembled, and this matter had been put to each of them, they all agreed that Belinus should accede to King Talicus' petition on the condition laid down. Belinus had no objection. King Talicus was released from prison, and he and the woman he loved went back to Denmark. Now that there remained no one in the whole realm of Britain who was prepared to resist Belinus, he took over the kingship of the entire island from sea to sea, and ratified the laws which his father had drawn up. He proclaimed that justice should be administered fairly throughout his kingdom. Above all, he decreed that cities and the roads leading to cities should have that right of sanctuary which Dunvalo had established. The roads themselves were a bone of contention, for no one knew just where their boundaries should be. The king was very keen to remove every ambiguity from this law. He summoned workmen from all over the island and ordered them to construct a road of stones and mortar which should bisect the island longitudinally from the Cornish Sea to the shore of Caithness and should lead in a straight line to each of the cities on the route. He then ordered a second road to be built, running west to east across the kingdom, from the town of St. David's on the Dimetian Sea over to Southampton, and again leading directly to the cities in between. He built two more roads, in a diagonal pattern across the island, to lead to the cities for which no provision had been made. Then he consecrated these highways in all honour and dignity, proclaiming it to be an integral part of his code of laws that punishment should be meted out to any person who committed an act of violence upon them. If anyone wishes to know the full details of the highway code, established by Belinus, he must read the Molmutine laws, which the historian Gildas translated from Welsh into Latin, and which King Alfred later rewrote in the English language. While Belinus was thus governing his kingdom in peace and tranquility, his brother Brennius was driven away to the coast of France, as I previously explained. Brennius was greatly discouraged, for he found it hard that he should have been expelled from his own country, and have no possibility of ever returning to enjoy the rank which he had lost. He was unable to make up his mind as to what he should do. With a retinue of only 12 knights, he visited the Gallic leaders and explained his misfortune to each of them in turn, but he did not succeed in persuading any of them to help him. In the end, he came to Segnius, the leader of the Allobroges, who received him honourably. Brennius stayed some time with Segnius, and came to be so friendly with him that no one else in that leader's entourage was as influential as he. Brennius showed such wisdom, both in peace and in war, no matter what was the business in hand, that Segnius came to love him as a father loves a son. Brennius was comely to look at, tall and well proportioned, and, as you would expect, he was highly skilled at hunting and hawking. He insinuated himself so far into the friendship of Duke Segnius that the latter finally decided that Brennius should marry his only daughter. If, as the years passed, no male heir should be born to Segnius, then the Duke bequeathed to Brennius, after his death, his own lordship over the Allobroges, these together with the hand of his daughter. If a son were to be born to Segnius, then he promised to help Brennius in his attempt to seize the kingdom of Britain. All this was agreed to not only by Duke Segnius, but also by all the leading warriors who bore allegiance to him. So far had Brennius established himself in their esteem. The girl was married to Brennius straight away. The nobles of the country were made subject to him, and the royal throne became his. The year in which these agreements were come to had not yet run its entire course, when the Duke's last day dawned and death claimed him. Brennius immediately took steps to put under an even closer obligation to himself those leaders with whom he had already become so friendly. He shared among them Duke Segnius' treasure, which had been hoarded since the time of his remote ancestors. What was even more attractive to the Allobroges, Brennius was most liberal in distributing food, and kept open house to everybody. Once Brennius had made himself popular with all about him, he pondered in secret how he could take vengeance on his brother, Belinus. He explained his position to the people under his rule, and they all agreed to follow him, to whichever kingdom he might choose to lead them. Without wasting time, he collected a huge army together, and then made a treaty with the Gauls, by which he was allowed to pass in peace through their provinces on his way towards Britain. He fitted out a fleet on the Normandy coast, put out to sea at a moment when the winds were favourable, and so landed on the Isle of Britain. The moment his brother Belinus learned of the coming of Brennius, he mustered the young men of his entire realm and marched forth to do battle with the invader. As the battalions on the two sides stood waiting in orderly array, ready to join battle, the very next instant, the mother of the two leaders, who was still alive, came hurrying through the serried ranks. Her name was Toluena, and she was passionately keen to see the son on whom she had not set eyes for so long. With trembling steps, she came to the place where Brennius stood, threw her arms around his neck, and kissed him repeatedly with all a mother's love. She bared her breasts before him, and in a voice broken with sobbing, she spoke to him as follows. "Remember, my son, remember these breasts which you once suckled. Remember the womb of your mother, in which the Creator of all things fashioned you as a man-child from stuff that was not yet human, bringing you forth into the world while the birth pangs tore at her vitals because of you. Remember all the care and anxiety which I endured for your sake, and then grant me my request, Forgive your brother. Curb the anger which is consuming you. You ought to have no ill feeling for Belinus, for he has done you no harm. As for your pretext that you were expelled from your own country by his doing, if you will only consent to examine the truth of the matter carefully, you will find nothing in it that you can possibly call injustice. Indeed, Belinus did not drive you into an exile, where something worse still was going to befall you. On the contrary, he forced you to abandon a humble position, so that you could raise yourself to a greater one. Once you were his subject, and you held only a part of this kingdom. Now that you have lost that part, you have made yourself the equal of Belinus, for you have seized the kingdom of the Allobroges. What else did Belinus do to you, apart from promoting you from your position as a petty princeling to that of a mighty king? Add to this the fact that the quarrel which arose between the two of you was started by you yourself, not by him. For you were passionately determined to rebel against him, and in this you relied upon the help of the King of Norway. Brennius was moved by what his weeping mother had said. Calmly and quietly he obeyed her. He took off his helmet and went with her to meet his brother. When Belinus saw him coming with a peaceful look on his face, he threw down his own weapons and ran forward to put his arms around Brennius and kiss him. There and then they became firm friends. Their troops disarmed, and they all entered the town of Trinovantium together. The two discussed with each other what they should do next. They decided to put one common army into the field, to lead this army into Gallic territory, and to subject to their joint dominion all the provinces of that country. 12 months later, Belinus and Brennius crossed over to Gaul and began to ravage the countryside there. When this became known to the Gallic tribes, all the Frankish princes came together to meet the invaders and fought against them. Belinus and Brennius were victorious, and the Franks fled in all directions, with the men of their battalions gravely wounded. Once they had won the pitched battle, the Britons and the Allobroges were relentless in their pursuit of the Gauls. They captured their kings and forced them to surrender. They garrisoned the towns which they had captured, and in 1 year they conquered the entire kingdom. When they had forced all the provinces of Gaul to submit, they set out for Rome with the whole of their immense army and began to plunder cities and farming communities up and down Italy. At that time, Gabius and Porsenna were the two consuls in Rome, and the jurisdiction of the country was in their hands. As soon as these two realized that no people were strong enough to resist the fury of Belinus and Brennius, they first sought the Senate's approval, and then came to the invaders to sue for peace and friendship. With them, they brought many gifts of gold and silver, together with a tribute to be repeated each year, if only they were permitted to retain their own possessions in peace. The two kings took hostages from the consuls, and then showed them mercy, leading their own troops off to Germany. No sooner had Belinus and Brennius begun harassing the German people than the Romans repented of the treaty just described. Their courage revived, and they marched forth to help the Germans. When the kings learned this, they were greatly incensed by it. They consulted each other to see how they could possibly fight two peoples at once. So great a force of Italian citizens had arrived that the Britons had much cause for anxiety. After due consultation with his brother, Belinus remained in Germany with his Britons and pressed on with the war against that enemy. Brennius, for his part, marched towards Rome with his own armies so that he might take vengeance on the Romans for having broken the treaty. When they heard this news, the Italians deserted the Germans. They hurried forward in an attempt to outmarch Brennius, hoping in this way to arrive back in Rome. Belinus was informed of this, and he disengaged his army. Once the next night was over, he set out at full speed and occupied a certain valley through which the enemy had to pass. Belinus hid in ambush along the bottom of this valley and waited for the enemy to arrive. At dawn on the next day, the Italians reached the place in question, as they pressed on with the journey which they had undertaken. When they saw before them the valley which was glittering with the arms of their foes, they were immediately filled with consternation, for they thought that it was Brennius who was there, with his Senonian Gauls. The moment the enemy came in sight, Belinus made a sudden charge at them, and attacked them with great ferocity. Without more ado, the Romans rushed headlong from the battlefield, for when attacked so unexpectedly, they had been marching in broken order, and without having put on their armour. Belinus pursued them mercilessly, never pausing in his slaughter until night came on and prevented him from completing the massacre. After this victory, Belinus followed the tracks of Brennius, who had now been besieging Rome for 3 days. The two brothers joined forces and attacked the city from all sides, doing their utmost to breach its walls. In their effort to cause even greater dismay, they erected gibbets in front of the city gateway and announced to the besieged that they would hang from the gallows tree the hostages whom the Romans had given, if these last would not agree to surrender. However, the Romans persevered in their endeavour. They were determined to defend themselves and took no pity on their sons and grandsons. First, they destroyed the attackers' siege machines with counterweapons, or indeed with identical devices. Then, they drove the invaders back from the walls with every conceivable kind of missile. The two brothers observed this. In the very insolence of their burning rage, they ordered 23 of the noblest of their hostages to be hanged in full sight of their relations. The Romans resisted all the more boldly. Encouraged by messengers from Gabius and Porsenna, who reported to the besieged that the consuls would arrive to relieve them on the following day, the Romans next determined to sally forth from the city and to do battle with their enemies. Just as they were ordering their lines of counterattack with great skill, lo and behold, the two above-mentioned consuls, who had reassembled their scattered troops, marched in, ready for the fight. They moved forwards in close file, and suddenly attacked the Allobroges and the Britons. With the help of the townsfolk who had sallied forth, the consuls succeeded in causing great slaughter in the early stages. When the two brothers saw the carnage which was being inflicted on their troops, they were really worried. They began to harangue their men, and to reform their lines of battle. By means of repeated waves of attack, the two kings drove the enemy backwards. Finally, when thousands of those engaged had been killed on either side, victory went to the two brothers. Gabius was killed, and Porsenna was captured. The city was invested, and the invaders distributed all the hidden treasures of the citizens among their own troops. Once he had won this victory, Brennius stayed on in Italy, where he treated the local people with unheard-of savagery. I have not attempted to describe his other activities there, or his eventual death, for the histories of Rome explain these matters. Had I myself done so, I should have made this work inordinately prolix, and by being covered by others, I should have turned aside from my purpose. Belinus, for his part, returned to Britain, and for the remaining days of his life governed his homeland in peace. He restored existing cities wherever they had fallen into decay, and he founded many new ones. Among the others which he founded was a certain city on the bank of the river Usk, near to the Severn Sea. This was the capital of Domitia, and for a long time it was called Carusc. When the Romans came, the earlier name was dropped, and it was renamed the City of the Legions, taking its title from the Roman legions who used to winter there. In the town of Trinovantium, Belinus caused to be constructed a gateway of extraordinary workmanship, which in his time the citizens called Billingsgate, from his own name. On the top of it, he built a tower which rose to a remarkable height, and down below at its foot he added a water gate which was convenient for those going on board their ships. He ratified his father's laws everywhere throughout the kingdom, taking pleasure in the proper administration of his own justice. As a result, in his time, there became available to the populace such an abundance of wealth as no previous age had ever witnessed, and no subsequent era was ever to acquire. Finally, when his last day dawned and carried him away from this life, his body was cremated and the ash enclosed in a golden urn. This urn, the citizens placed with extraordinary skill on the very top of the tower in Triniventium, which I have already described.
RadioArian.com.